All right, good morning. It is 9:02, and I'll like to call this meeting of the Workforce Committee to order. Winner, will you please take roll? We're Catherine.
Chair Brown.
Present.
Vice Chair Del Carlo.
I'm on Zoom, but I'm here.
Regent Braga?
Here.
Regent Gokutia?
Here.
And Regent McGrath?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you so much. Regent Braga, will you please lead us in the pledge?
Certainly. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands. One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
That's a me.
Don't try to get ahead of me.
Okay. Oh, it went off anyway.
Before beginning, we take a moment to recognize that here in Nevada, we stand on the land of the Washishu, Washu, Numu, Northern Paiute, Nui, Western Shoshone, and Nuwu, Southern Paiute. We take a moment to recognize and honor their stewardship that continues into today. With this recognition, we state the intention to rightfully include their voice and respect them as the 27 tribal nations of Nevada. For those of you who would like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171 and enter in meeting ID 933-5568. 7402 and passcode 555555. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There is none at this time.
Thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
Yes, there is.
Great.
Amy Payson, AMYPASON, and I am speaking on behalf of the faculty in the Communication Studies Department at UNR. I'm speaking on item number 5. It's validating to see that Communication Studies, and particularly public speaking courses, are listed in the top 10 most enrolled courses and subject areas in all the industry areas, except apparently computer and math occupations. So let me tell you the good news about how my department is contributing to skilling our workforce. In a given semester, we teach over 350 students in public speaking courses. In a given semester, we teach nearly 200 students enrolled in intercultural communication. 30% of those are coming from public health or pre-nursing areas. We currently offer 20 sections of public speaking for concurrent enrollment students, serving over 500 students in 11 Las Vegas high schools. We offer our major and minor both in person, and now you can get fully we have fully online degrees for our undergraduates, and we offer an MA degree, the only graduate program in this area in the state. There are 43 degree programs from 7 different schools and colleges that require or recommend communication courses for their majors or minors. Here's the bad news. Since 2022, our department has seen 6 tenure-track faculty leave UNR. We've held those positions vacant. One of those position lines was totally lost as a permanent budget reduction. We've only been able to hire 2 replacements. Holding positions vacant means that courses do not get taught. What this means for us is that 44% of all of our undergraduate courses were taught by LOAs, 70% of those were taught as online courses because we have to look outside of the state to find people to teach our courses. This means that a majority of our public speaking courses were taught by LOAs. This means that this time last year, the associate faculty member that we have had directing our concurrent enrollment was concurrently acting as our department chair, was teaching his own courses, was overseeing our graduate TAs, and doing the concurrent enrollment program. If we do not get more resources, it means we have to cut. So unfortunately, I think this may be one of the last years that we do concurrent enrollment for the Collegiate Academy because we just simply do not have enough faculty to serve our state in this way. Thank you.
That concludes our public comment in Reno.
Thank you. Do we have any public comment here in Las Vegas? Okay, seeing none. SES, is there any public comment on the phones?
There's no public comment at this time.
All right, thank you. All right, we're going to move to agenda item number two, minutes, and the committee will consider approval of the minutes from the June 25th meeting.
If there's no comments or changes, I make a motion for acceptance.
I move for a second that. This is Carol Del Carlo for the record.
Thank you. I have a motion from Regent Brager, a second by Regent Del Carlo. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. We've approved the minutes. Next, we're going to move into the chair's report. So, before we dive into today's agenda, I want to take a moment to reflect on where we are and where we're heading as a committee. As you know, we recently passed a major update for credit for prior learning policy, and I've heard a lot of questions since then, so I want to clear up a few things. First and foremost, this isn't about giving college credit just for the time spent in a job or years of experience. It's about recognizing real, demonstrated learning, skills and knowledge that match what students want to learn, would have learned in a classroom. That means that this isn't a shortcut. This is a careful evaluation, that includes deep faculty involvement and real commitment to doing the right thing across the entire system. And I want to thank the faculty and staff who have stepped up to help with this work. This is a big shift for some, but I truly believe it's improving that student-centered policies that still uphold academic rigor. For many of our students, especially working adults, veterans, and career changers, this change can be life-changing. We're helping them save time, reduce costs, and move forward faster. That's a win for our institution, for our workforce, and for our state. But we're not done. Credit for prior learning is just the start of a much bigger push to make our system more responsive and more aligned with the need of Nevada's future. That means looking forward and looking closely at things like credit mobility, industry alignment, aligned credentials, tech transfer, and entrepreneurship. I think it's time that we take another look at the mission and scope of the committee and make sure it reflects the incredible economic and workforce potential we have as a system. At the end of the day, our job is to help build the bridges between higher education opportunity and the economy. And that's what this committee was built for, and I'm excited for what's to come next. Thanks for being so much part of this work, and look forward to all the great stuff down the pike. Okay, we are moving into agenda number four, credit alignment. Daniel, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, Dr. Daniel Archer.
Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. Daniel Archer, for the record, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, Nevada System of Higher Education. I just want to start out with kind of a timeline of how we got here, and just to provide some context and background here. So, this work was really rooted in pre-strategic planning work that went down in 21 and 22. I, of course, was not here, but I did go back and listen to every minute of these. And we had 13 listening sessions, again, across the state. Some were on campuses, some were off campus. And one of the recurring themes that emerged from multiple visits was that we needed to be more active in the credit for prior learning space here. So that really planted the seeds for this work here. Right thereafter, we had some staff turnover, some board turnover, chancellor turnover. So we really jumped back into full strategic planning mode in 2024. And we did that. We knew there was a really strong interest in credit for prior learning. We knew that from the listening sessions. We knew that from conversations that we at the system office had within the workforce committee and with our institutions. We knew that from conversations that we had with K-12 partners. So we knew there was broad interest in this, but the big question for us is, what did the data say about credit for prior learning? And so when you look at the national evidence on credit for prior learning, it's really evident, very clear that CPL works, and it works in a way that really moves the needle for both Nevada students and Nevada families here. So just looking at tuition savings here, you'll see that students who earn just 12 credit hours of credit for prior learning save nearly $4,000 at public universities here. So obviously there's cost savings there. Students at community colleges with credit for prior learning complete 14 months sooner than those who have no credit for prior learning. So a year of someone's life, we're talking about 14 months, is a big deal. It's especially, I think, a big deal for working adults who are balancing jobs and childcare and sometimes military service. We're talking about getting people into the workforce sooner, which means less debt as well. So all those things I think that we want to accomplish at the end of the day are there. And then lastly, with completion here, you'll see that students who have credit for prior learning versus those who do not have credit for prior learning are far more likely to complete, 17% more likely to complete here. And so CPL or credit for prior learning is something that really works. But the other question is this something that's a fit for Nevada here? And so you'll see a set of challenges that I think are very real, but you'll also see a set of opportunities where CPL can make a very meaningful difference here. You'll see the adult student enrollments decline in recent years. We look at 321,000 adults with some college and no degree. There's a great opportunity to tap into this group here to re-engage, reconnect with them, and award credit where credit is due, and get them back in the higher ed pipeline there. And then you look at the adult completion rate. We're talking about the percentage of adults who have an associate degree or higher. That national rate is 47%. In Nevada, we are at 36%, so we are 11 percentage points lower than that national rate here. So when it's all said and done, CPL, I think, is very impactful because it tackles challenges like this, but it also moves the needle in areas where it really counts and matters here. So again, we go back to our original timeline here. We put the finishing touches on the strategic plan in late 2024, about this time last year. And then, of course, the strategic plan was ultimately approved in January of 2025. From there, we did put a specific emphasis on credit for prior learning there. From there, we did write a grant. We knew that we were going to need some resources, some expertise, some additional support to advance credit for prior learning as a system, so we were able to apply for a grant. As I said last week, there were 10 states that applied for this grant. Only two were awarded, so we were one of two states. So we're excited about working on that project there. And then this body, in terms of the Workforce Committee, approved the policy amendments last summer, and then the board subsequently approved those in September of 2025. And that really put the wheels in motion. Once we had that policy approval, that put the wheels in motion for some very significant and meaningful work here. And so, you know, we had the policy that was approved. You know, the question is, what happened afterward? You know, as a board member, you approve a policy. So what actually happens after? And in this case, a lot has actually happened in a relatively short period of time here. We've had a project that we've called Align 89. Essentially, we have aligned the credit for prior learning, the credit that is awarded on 89 exams, and I'll talk about that here in a moment, but just to provide some context around the exams that we're focused on here, these are nationally recognized exams, the first being Advanced Placement, or AP, is the most common by far. You'll see here that this was administered to over 40,000 Nevada high school students in 2024, so it's kind of like an honors high school class, as many of you all are aware of. And then you have an opportunity to take an exam at the end of the year, and if you earn a requisite score, there's opportunities to earn collegiate credit. CLEP is something that's offered in our testing centers at our colleges and universities. Again, you go in, take a test, opportunities to earn collegiate credit, and then International Baccalaureate is very similar to AP. It's something that is not new, but it's new to Nevada and really new to the United States. It's something that's based out of the UK, but it's becoming increasingly more common. We have a school district up north that is a heavy IB user, and then we have some charter schools here in the Valley that are using International Baccalaureate as well. So we're seeing more and more of this. But again, why are we doing this work here? As I've talked about before, historically, students have been able to earn credit for prior learning through AP, through a CLEP and an IB exams. But the way those scores have translated into credit has not been consistent across ENCHI here. If you are a student or a parent in our state and you want to kind of map out how credit for prior learning works across our system in terms of the credit awarded, this is really what it looks like here. You see a lot of crisscrossing everywhere. You have a lot of uneven paths from one institution to the next. You have really no clear lines of demarcation here. So students have had to navigate kind of a tangled map full of zigzags, in some cases dead ends. Sometimes there's been really no credit awarded here. And so we knew there were concerns about this. We've heard feedback from high school teachers, from high school counselors, from school boards. This was something, it was a topic of conversation at a Clark County School District meeting this last spring about the inconsistencies within ENCHI on AP exams specifically here. So when you hear kind of the same thing from different people at different places at different times, it usually signals that there is a problem. So we rolled up our sleeves and got to work here, and we knew that this couldn't be kind of a quick top-down fix here. It had to be something that we were doing with our faculty rather than to them. So this was very much true system-wide collaboration with INSHE and our academic and student affairs staff, working with our seven institutions, working with our provost, working with our faculty. So again, this was very much a collaborative effort. So 33 disciplines came together in September and October to review 89 exams. So again, we facilitated 33 separate meetings to review 89 exams here. So for each exam review, the faculty recommended, number one, a common requisite score, and then number two, the common course credit that is associated with that respective score here. So again, this work was done in September and October of 2025. And doing this work, we turned kind of a tangled, inconsistent inventory into one with really clean lines and clear expectations, and I think very simple navigation. I think through a system lens, we want to try to simplify things as much as possible for our students and our Nevada families here. And so we had our faculty review those exams, and then we had our Academic Affairs Council, which is comprised of the academic vice presidents. They meet monthly. We last met on December 3rd. They reviewed the recommendations made by the faculty. They approved 88 of the 89. There's one where we have kind of a loose end to tie up that kind of got into two different disciplines, which shouldn't be a big deal. It just require a little bit extra work to kind of tie up that loose end, but 88 of 89 have been approved. Significant work has been done in this space in a relatively short period of time. We will have a system-wide inventory. We'll get that one loose end tied up at the beginning of the year, and then we will roll the inventory out and start putting it on our website, start obviously communicating it to K-12. Again, I want to emphasize this is something that is very much going to benefit K-12 and something they're very much looking forward to. I've had a number of conversations with high school counselors, with teachers, and they are very excited about this work that will make their jobs, I think, a lot easier and a lot more simplistic here. In terms of what this means on the most practical level, I'm almost done here. Just got a couple of slides here, so I'm bringing back the Lego set here. And in terms of what this means on a practical level here, when you kind of look at before and after examples, so financial accounting, a very common CLEP exam. You have people who have acquired accounting skills. They don't necessarily need to take that introductory accounting class. So there's an opportunity for them to go in and take an exam. Before the alignment, you'll see that one of our campuses said you get financial accounting, you get managerial accounting, you get a total of 6 hours. Two campuses said you get financial accounting, which is 3 hours. One campus said you get 3 hours of elective credit, and it's very important to note that in some cases, elective credit is not really beneficial because some of our programs are very prescriptive and there's not really any room for electives. And then three campuses said you don't get any hours. So you have the same score, same exam, but four different credit outputs. It kind of depends on who you ask and where you go. And so after the alignment now, this will read far more favorably, far more simplistic. All seven campuses are on the same page. We're all marching the same direction. We're all singing from the same hymn. You get financial accounting if you earn that requisite score, and you get 3 credit hours. And a very similar example here with the International Baccalaureate. This is one of the math exams here. There were two campuses that awarded 3 hours of credit, and then there were five campuses that didn't award any credit. So this was one that was very limiting. And after that alignment, after bringing faculty together, we have a very different outcome and output here. Students who are earning that requisite score now at all seven campuses are earning 9 hours of credit. They're getting the pre-calculus and the trig, and they're also getting calculus one. So we went from 3 hours or 0 hours to 9 hours, and we went from elective credit or no credit to actual credit, an actual credit that often ties to a degree requirement. So we're in a much better place having done this work. Again, want to thank everybody involved. This was very much a group effort. Want to thank our faculty, want to thank the individuals who facilitated these meetings. We did a lot of those in terms of the academic and student affairs, but we also asked the institutions to help and support that, and they were great. So we had some great facilitators. Want to thank our academic vice presidents for their support. Our registrars, we're kind of handing this over to them now because essentially the big question is, how do we transcript this? How do we make sure that we're doing it in a consistent and standardized way for simplicity and clarity purposes? So they are working on it now. So this is a project that is involving hundreds and hundreds of INSHE employees, but will ultimately benefit thousands and thousands of students. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you so much. I will open it up for questions to members of the committee. Regent Brager.
Susan Brager for the record. You know, I stopped by your office and spoke to you because I feel like credit for prior learning is going to be a challenge across the board. And I use the example of, and I'll be brief, I know we have other items, of real estate agents. We take, right now they need 36 hours every 2 years, right? So someone that's been in 10 years, well, it used to be 24, but anyway. With all those hours and the different types of classes, from banking to, like, let's say I don't put all the letters behind my name, but I have five or six different types of letters that if I wanted, I guess, look important or something, I could do that. But I mean, things from G-certified to work with FBI or CIA, right, from Graduate of Realtor Institute, all those things. I guess what I'm looking for, and maybe it would promote, we have about 14,000 or maybe about 18,000 real estate agents across the state. So real estate isn't what it used to be. I think it's amazing, but it's technically, and I don't like to just go out there like that, it's very challenging what's changed across the states with different lawsuits and requirements, and people are thinking, like, maybe it's not for me. How do we, when we have, some of them might have college already. You spoke about approximately 312,000 people that have some sort of college, but how do we get them to know that we can not look at them for a four-year degree, but coming to our system to get more educated? Do we pick an industry and speak with their higher-ups to go after that so that we can increase what's happening on our college campuses? More than likely, I think they would feed more into, and this is just how I feel, to our, I started to say career technical academies, CSNs or NSU. And I think that if we don't start looking at, in this big picture, what can AI not take over? I feel emphatical about this, that we need to be looking at our college system, not just for how we get people to come, but what do we teach in the credit to prior learning that have jobs that could be taken away, and that we look at that more seriously. And that is going to impact the NSUs and the CSNs more than, I think, our four-year institutions, which are still necessary for doctor, lawyer, you know, things that engineers, those types of things. But we need to be more broad-scoped. I feel like education is for everyone if we get to them properly. And I don't think we've always done that. And I love promoting education. I feel like it's very important whether you're 18 or you're 80. But that's what our system should be about. And I don't think we're quite there yet. So not really, I guess, a question to you. But I do think because it's so broad-scoped industry-wise out there, even people that are on the strip that have been dealing cards for all these years, it doesn't mean they're not educated.
Right.
And just quickly, I went to a meeting once when I was going to run for this position, and they asked me, well, I own a limousine company. Why do my drivers need an education? And instantly it was, maybe they want to own your company one day. And so they kind of took a breath back like, oh, didn't think like that. It doesn't mean someone is not educated, right, in certain positions of where we are in life, but we can promote more education. And so that's where I'm at right now is, do we pick an industry and go for it full steam ahead and get people to know? And then they're going to talk to other people that they know. How do we encourage this credit to, I just went blank, credit for prior learning? And so I really feel like we need to dig deeper.
Yeah.
And I love this committee, and I even asked to be on it because I love what Heather is doing and how she feels. And that passion is important to me on where we go and how we get there. So in the future, I think we need to dig deeper. I think we need to look at industry. I may be wrong,
No, you're right.
I do think that that's where we could instill people coming back. Maybe they don't get that four-year degree. The four-year degree is a piece of paper. What do you do with it?
Right.
Is there the job for it? In the 80s, everybody went to be an engineer, and guess what? There were no jobs because so many of them came out like that. We need to direct people and have paths of education. Sorry, this is really passionate to me. We have to have paths of education that mean something when they're done. Not that they got a degree, but what they can do with it and where they go from there. And that's what I love about our CSN campuses and our rural campuses, is that they are teaching those that can really get into the workforce and have an amazing, consistent job for life. I'll be quiet, but I really feel strong about this.
Regent Carvalho.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity to comment. Really kind of following up on Regent Brager's comments, I attended the monthly meeting of the State Board of Education yesterday, and we talked about teacher training and attracting teachers, and they sometimes have barriers for teachers to come teach within Nevada. And so I did bring up that we are doing this incredible work at NG with credit for prior learning. And I wonder if there is any, if there's been any work done for teacher training. But it also makes me think when Regent Brager brought up real estate agents, both of these areas are licensed in the state of Nevada. And I know that Governor Lombardo at one time was talking about trying to make licensing more streamlined. And that may be a little bit different than what we're talking about today, although I think the educational components of both of those licenses might be kind of confusing for some people. So I do wonder if we, if we've had any discussion about looking at that for people who are interested in becoming teachers and getting involved in education, as well as real estate agents also. I'll also say that I really appreciate slide 3 of your presentation, where you mentioned that there's a lot of opportunity for our institutions with regard to students who are over age 25. I've been saying that I think that's an area that we need to tap into a bit more. We can't rely on just high school graduates anymore, especially moving into the future. And so you've done a good job with that slide in illustrating this gap very well. So I appreciate that. And I also just want to say, Dr. Archer, that you do an excellent job on your presentations. You put a lot of thought and creativity into those, so I just wanted to say thank you for that as well.
Daniel Archer, for the record, thank you so much. I do want to emphasize that really these tests, the things that we focus on today, are really kind of the low-hanging fruit. So this is just very much a starting point. We definitely see working with industry partners ultimately is where we want to end up. And we were able to get the grant, and we do have a coach that's working with our institutions that is based out of the University of Memphis, and they have done some of the most innovative work in that space in the country. And so I think we will have updates about things that we want to focus on in terms of specific industries or things that we want to do as a state versus things that would be more institutional. I know that our grant partner, which is Student Ready Strategies, Inc., again, has brought in this coach from University of Memphis. We're all kind of working together. But Student Ready Strategies, Inc. has done kind of a deep inventory and working with institutions, kind of finding out what are you doing right now, where are some of the gaps, what are the things you're interested in. And we were going to look at that at the end of the year, or the very first of the year, and really kind of reprioritize where do we want to go from here. We've got these exams done. This is a big step, but we know there's so much more work that can be done. So I definitely think there'll be more opportunities, and I think opportunities, obviously, for this committee to be engaged and dialed into our work. So I think your points you made were great, and I think we're on the same page. And in reference to the teaching aspect here, Dr. Natalie Brown is here, and she can probably elaborate on that a little more.
Thank you. Natalie Brown, Assistant Vice Chancellor for Workforce Development and Community Colleges, for the record. Well, I want to speak to a couple different things. First, talking about different groups and audiences, such as realtors. This is definitely an opportunity for outreach. Now, and being not a homogenous group with the same interests and ideas on where they want to go in their education, this harkens back to what Regent Brown was saying in her chair remarks, is this is really about those skills. This is about what each individual is looking at doing as far as their educational goal, having those conversations with our institutions about how we can help them reach that, and then combine that experience and the time that they've spent in a career. Does it align with some of the requirements in a course or a program? Can we help them get there faster without retaking anything they've already really met those student learning outcomes for? And, where that individual ends up going, I think that's an opportunity for all of our institutions, and where we can as a system really highlight some of these great programs that each of our institutions offer that might be a good fit, a good segue from, what they're currently doing into a new career path. And so lots of opportunities, I think, across the spectrum. But again, having those individualized conversations and looking at what are the educational goals and then how can we align what they bring to the table to help them get there a little bit faster. Now, in an education space, yes, that's another great opportunity. Now, if there's a particular licensure, certifications, those kind of things we can bring to the table, I mean, wonderful. Yes, let's get them to that end goal faster. And in the teaching and learning space, that is an opportunity where we've been working very closely, not only with our K-12 partners, with our colleges and universities, with NDE, but how can we streamline that in a number of different ways? So that can happen through potentially credit for prior learning. You know, we have some great apprenticeship programs to move individuals through, and as well as some of our alignment in our education program. So that's something we've been working on pretty readily this last year and a half or so.
And this is just an example. So I have 432 credit hours, not that required, not counting what you take outside of that to make you more broad-scoped in your career. And that's, I guess, where I'm going is, how are we even going to decipher that? And I know this is a future conversation, but just think of how many, that's across the board. That's, I mean, that's with 35 years, but some have 20 and 30. And I think in today's world, the reason why I think further education is so important, people can't retire at 60, 65 unless you've been in a government job. No disrespect, but that's about the only way that you can do it. In the real life world, because I do think government jobs are uniquely different with the PERS and everything else that you get to do, I think that those people, the other people, and some that do work here 40 and 50 years, is going to be longer. So they're going to look at different fields they can go into. That's just where I'm going with all this. I think it's so amazing and so incredible, but we have to start having classes that can meet the needs of the future. And I don't think we're quite there yet of what our eighth graders are going to need when they get to college. We're not at that point. What's going to really be there that AI has not taken over? So thank you. I think this is an amazing start. And I really look to our CSNs to pick the ball up and be able to really, you know, run with that to create what's going to be new created.
Madam Chair, I don't know how to put my hand up on the screen, so I've got it up on my face. If just a comment.
Yeah, of course, Regent Goguchia.
Thank you. I just along these lines, and real learning curve for me as well. I've been out of school a long time, but right now we seem to be kind of focused on the K-12 piece of it. I'm wondering, how does, you know, a person that might be interested, had some prior college, how do they access this? Do they go in and take the CLEP exam, or they go to a college? How are we going to move into this, and where we've got these people that can actually, you know, take an exam someplace and get a credit for prior learning, and, you know, how are we going to reach those people? The people like Regent Brazier's talking about, the people that are 25, 30 years, 40 years old, and just trying to, you know, they might go back. They might take some classes if, in fact, it benefited their career. How are we going to access those? Right now, we're looking at K-12, it looks like, and they're in the institutions. But how do we reach those people that are out there in a career that this would really benefit?
Yes, Daniel Archer for the record. So, yeah, just to elaborate on the K-12 piece, like you said, they are in the school. So I think it's a matter from our standpoint of making sure that we're communicating to the high school counselors, to the school districts, obviously to NDE, making sure that they know about the inventories, they know about the options. The test really should be built in there in terms of they take a test usually in May, and that's built into a school day. So you have the structure there. Now on the CLEP, and I think some of the other things that we do that probably would cater more to adult audiences, I think obviously it may depend on the industry. I think one of the things that we'll want to do ultimately in doing this work, obviously we have to have the budget for it, and there's all kinds of conversations, but I would love for us to develop a really comprehensive marketing plan with the adult student in mind. So I think there's real opportunities there. I think if we can build some of these foundational pieces, then I think we can come together and figure out how we want to sell it and package it and make it all work.
President Klubenstein.
Thank you very much, Chair Brown, members of the board. Stacy Klippenstein for the record. It's a pleasure to be here today and good morning. I'm really, really encouraged by the work that has been done. I really do appreciate Dr. Archer taking the leadership and all of our 89 faculty and everybody else heavily involved and will continue to be involved. I just wanted to reiterate and share a few things where I greatly value the views that Regent Carvalho and also Brager just mentioned, and it resonates very, very well because it's always been in the community college space. And that continue, if you look at our average age, we're running 25 to 26. We know almost 40 something percent are 25 and older. We're hitting an adult market. And there's a reason for that, because they see an easy entry point, right? We don't have, we're an open door policy. We're gonna try to meet them where they're at and help them get through where they need to go to get whatever degree pathway or certificate pathway they're looking for. And so we will continue to be in that space. And I've always found credit for prior learning has been a great other entry point in an allowance for assessing and analyzing that pre-work, that those other credentials that they've received in their jobs, and being able to assess that and align it. Taking the real estate thing as an example, if you have 400 plus hours or 300 plus or multiple certifications, there's learning that's involved. And if you can align that and match that up, if they want to come in and do an associate's in business or marketing or whatever else, you can align those up. And that's what this program really attempts to do, and really happy with that. And even coming up on another agenda item, but it resonates with me in this regard, as we continue to work with adults and stuff. And when you match it up and align the marketing, hitting the 321,000 that have some, right, some college but didn't achieve an attainment, you're trying to better market and build in CTE pathways and dual enrollment. So high schools, those kids see that pathway and they can get right in it right away. There's a lot of value within that. And so looking at the labor market analysis and upcoming here in a few minutes by Dr. Natalie Brown, there's some really, really good information on there that's where everything starts to align. If we say we have 5 to 10 high demand occupations that's needed over the next 10 years, how are we aligning all of this work, those 321,000 high school kids coming up through? And so I'm really encouraged by the work and what CSN can provide in the space, but all community colleges do this. And I know a lot of universities are really, really digging into this as well. So I can see it as a concerted effort. So I just wanted to say that I was very, very happy to hear this information. Count CSN as far as digging into it even further, working with the CPL angle, which is very good. One of the things I wanted to share, it also aligns with this, is this discussion about the enrollment cliff in high school students. And I do take the comment by Regent Kokichia very seriously as well. It's not just about the high schools. It is really truly about the 321,000, that 25-year-old, that 22-year-old non-traditional student who's a student parent. It's about helping them get on that, whatever that pathway may be. With that, though, the one thing that I have seen work very, very well now, and it's growing and growing and growing, is the view of the non-credit versus the for-credit space. The more that we're involved in taking a look at the short-term credentialing that aligns with the high-demand job needs, and if you can take that and build that in to help somebody upskill and reskill, that's what's also very, very important in this space. So all of it, what I'm trying to say is when we look at strategic enrollment planning, our future growth, you got to count non-credit and for-credit, but that non-credit side needs to be part of this dialogue as well as we move forward. So I just want to say thank you very much and count us in. Thank you.
Thank you. And I want to say thank you to my colleagues, Vice Chancellor Archer, Dr. Brown and President Klippenstein. This is the dialogue I want to have. And I've been taking a little note, so I just want to kind of, Regent Gogachia, I really appreciate asking that question because this was maybe like 2 years ago, I remember seeing a speech about, well, you know, AI is going to be able to read CAT scans and radiology reports so much better, so don't go into that profession. That's not for you. That was actually the opposite of what happened. Because AI was so good, it actually increased the need for radiologist technicians to read the reports. And so I just sat in the ARSA committee last week, and I listened to our different academic affairs officers talk about how they on each campus are taking a look at our degrees that we're offering, making pivots and changing for how learning will take place in future years. And I really appreciate that they're being forward-thinking. I said it in that meeting, and I'll reiterate that here. And I think what we're doing here with the credit for prior learning and all of the future changes that we want to introduce, that's an overlay. So our campuses have to start thinking strategically. They are doing that. They're making the changes where needed. Now we're thinking about how external work can actually overlay into getting degrees. I think the reason why, and we started with the students because I like your slide number 12. I love the Lego blocks. Building blocks for, you know, copyright infringement. The building blocks. I like this visualization because in a system approach, there should not be four different ways that a student can matriculate with whatever they received outside of the classroom, and outside of one of our institutions. And so I'm really proud that that was the first step, and it's the 89 courses that were just black and white. There weren't any, Regent Brager brought up good points of, you know, things that we have to discuss, and we have to figure, we've put a value add on that because it's not a one-for-one for something that they would necessarily learn in the classroom, but it could be applied to something. And so I'm glad to see that we're moving towards unification. So now there's no shopping for venues,
right?
People aren't jumping between our institutions, having more staff time, because that's the thing that we don't always take into account is the staff time and the cost of that. If somebody is getting credits at one institution, transferring to another, now we've got two different registrars that have to, and there's a chance that they're going to get something wrong in the process. Then they have to take a semester off or whatever the problem is. Now we've fixed that. We've eliminated that. And so I'm just really excited that not only did we, you know, I had written down your AP students. There's only 25,000 students in the state that are taking AP credits. Like, to me, that's significant given how many students we have across the state. That's a very low percentage. But then we layer in, you know, dual enrollment and concurrent enrollment, you know, these other opportunities. And then when we start to add all that up, we're at least capturing these 17 and 18-year-olds now, getting them embedded into the higher ed system so there isn't that gap year, there isn't that having to come back and market to these adult learners and get, you know, trying to get their credit for prior learning. There's three different approaches here, and we have to take all three of them. We have to go with the current students, making sure that they have, they're in degrees that will, you know, not just be a piece of paper on their wall, but a career. High school students, getting them excited to go to an NCHE institution. And then our adult learners, the 321,000 here in Clark County, and we've been talking about this number for quite a bit. These are, I think, that 321,000, they have some type of higher ed credentialing, and they never finished. And now we want them to come back, and we want to put them through the process of credit for prior learning. So I think everybody brought up so many good points, and we really do have three different strategies that we're implementing, and I'm just happy that you said in Q1 we're going to be able to roll out the inventory for at least the 88, 89 classes, and that at least gets the ball rolling. Yeah, please.
I shouldn't be on this committee because I care a lot. So one other question quickly. How are we going about, and maybe it's in the wrong meeting here, the career technical academies where at least 90% of the students go on to college, but I don't know the percentage right now of how many don't go here. Do we have a team, or you think I would know this already, that really visits those campuses to where we have three universities now? They should be able to pick one of them that would meet their needs. Yes, some are going to go out of state no matter what. They just want to experience that, or at least go up to, let's say, UNR, which would, you know, but maybe those kids can come here. When you have a high percentage of students who go to college, are we out there in their face so we can get them to stay within our state? Because it's so proven, even for the medical or dental school, when they leave somewhere else to go take what they need, they rarely come back. So, and I even spoke to students the whole time I was a trustee at the graduations. You know, I hope you come back even though you're going to ABC College. But now we have so much more. So that interests me, and it doesn't even need to be in this meeting, that how are we promoting? I don't think it's promoted enough. And I was in the system, so I know that I don't know if that's changed very much, and I hope that it does in the future.
Yeah, Daniel Archer, I think there's all kinds of opportunities for growth there. And I think one of the things we'd like to see is if we can lay out really explicit paths where we're really connecting with K-12, like these are the classes you need if you want to be a teacher. These are the classes you need if you want to be an accountant. These are the ones, the pre-engineering courses, and we can have that consistently that applies at all seven institutions. I think there's endless opportunities there to cross-pollinate and work together. And I think to some of the points you made earlier, I mean, I think we are going to have to think a lot differently about certificates because some people are very cynical of higher education. We're going to need to be very explicit and clear in our messaging about if you are able to acquire this certificate and complete 9 hours, then you're eligible to get this job, you're eligible to make this amount of money, and then here's the career ladder, though. If you go on and get a degree, then you'll be able to get promoted. You'll be able to make X number of dollars more. And I think we're going to have to think strategically more along those lines.
I agree.
And have those career, think more along the lines of career ladders and specific checkpoints, because I think that's what the public is going to be a lot more receptive to.
And that would be exciting. And, you know, the career technical academies, each one is different. So it'd be a different group of people that would go there to meet with them. I mean, they have from, you know, pilots to chefs to, I mean, I could go on. Those were an amazing creation, if I say so. And so I just think that we need to tap into that a little bit better. Thank you so much. And this is amazing. I'm not a good meeting person, but this is one that I thoroughly always enjoy.
Thank you so much, Vice Chancellor Archer. Okay, we are going to go to agenda number 5, Program Demand Gap Analysis, Part 2. We've got, is someone up north? Stinman, oh, there, yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for the record, Dr. Fred Steinman, Director of the University Center for Economic Development and Principal Investigator of the Nevada Tech Hub here at the University of Nevada, Reno. I do have a quick presentation for you. I don't know if that's been pulled up yet. Oh, there we go. Also joining me is Andrew Woods, Director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the Lee Business School at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And as I promised him I would do today, I congratulate him and everyone at UNLV for keeping the Fremont Cannon red. Hopefully we'll get some just revenge next year and ultimately bring the cannon back home to Reno. Today's presentation, as mentioned by the chair, is again kind of part two of our ongoing program demand gap analysis, examining various trends within the workforce for the state of Nevada, both for individual metro areas within the state and for the state as a whole. And then as part of this part two, really tying that to degree, certificate, and enrollment data for generally the 2024-25 academic year for all the Nevada System of Higher Education institutions within the state. Next slide. Just very quickly, wanted to recognize the research team involved, both faculty and staff at the Center for Economic Development here at UNR. But again, also wanted to thank Andrew and his team at the Center for Business and Economic Research for their work on this as well. Also wanted to take this opportunity to kind of highlight the importance, obviously, of workforce development issues within the state of Nevada, both the work that Andrew and his team at the Center for Business and Economic Research at UNLV do and the work we do here at the Center for Economic Development and through the Nevada Tech Hub. One of the consistent messages we continue to hear from the private sector, especially employees in key emerging industry and occupation sectors, is that employers over the last 5 to 10 years throughout the state are finding it increasingly difficult to find individuals to fill vacant, open, and newly created positions. This is, to a degree, been anecdotal discussions with the 8 regional economic development authorities organized under the Governor's Office of Economic Development operating through the states, but also as we're starting to see in both Census Bureau data, data produced and published by the Nevada Department of Employment Training Rehabilitation, as well as the U.S. Bureau of Labor and Statistics and other data sources, there's kind of a growing mismatch between the existing workforce available to fill new and existing open vacancies and positions in those key and emerging industry sectors, but where those workers are essentially available in. A lot of our new industry sectors are really occurring and developing within the non-metro parts of the state, especially as cost of living and availability of land becomes an increasing issue in our 3 metro areas. But of course, where our population is, about 90 to 92% of it within those 3 metro areas is not necessarily located where those new employment opportunities are occurring today and where they're likely to occur within the next decade or so. So again, both the work at the Center for Business and Economic Research and the work we do here at the Center for Economic Development is really uncovering is kind of the general conclusion that workforce and the availability of a trained and skilled workforce in those key industry and occupation sectors has really become a limiting factor on a wide variety of economic development and diversification efforts. Next slide. To talk about the general study in front of you today, the study really is compiled within 2 separate USED technical reports. The last one presented to you back in April of this year really is a comprehensive analysis of the change in total employment, different measures of both hourly wages and annual incomes and location quotients for every single major and detailed occupation sector for the United States, for the state of Nevada, and for each of our 3 metro MSAs. The secondary technical report, hopefully included in your packets today, really kind of ties that to graduation and enrollment data across all the NGE institutions for the 2024-25 academic year. Again, trying to determine whether or not the NGE institutions are either enrolling or graduating students with the desired skill sets and whatever certification or degree requirements employers might have in those targeted occupation sectors. Ultimately, the real value of a program gap analysis like this is first and foremost to inform those institutions and those parties that are most responsible for producing that workforce. Better alignment between the programs, the certificates, the degrees, the special education and training programs development, and what that existing and future demand in the workforce by employers are going to be is really essential, again, to continue to support those broader community and economic development and diversification efforts. And of course, after today, looking forward to working with Dr. Brown and Andrew and others to share this information with employers throughout the state, as well as those regional development authorities and other economic development organizations. Next slide. At this point, I'd like to hand off the presentation to Andrew Woods, again, Director of the Center for Business and Economic Research. He and his team did quite a bit of work on identifying and projecting where demand for employers in key industry and occupation sectors are. So, Andrew, I'll hand it to you.
Dr. Simon, thank you so much. Looking forward to seeing you in a photo on Monday with wearing UNLV Rebel gear. So, Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for having me. I am Andrew Woods. I am the director of UNLV's Center for Business and Economic Research. We've been working with USED up north on his program evaluation. Since 1997, we have conducted the Clark County population forecast, which we do on behalf of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, the Clark County, for the government of Clark County, as well as for the Regional Transportation Commission of Southern Nevada. And this forecast is not just for Clark, but we do it also for the state and for Washoe County and the world. What we were asked to do is present very quickly the forecast for employment and the top sectors that we see for growth over the next 10 years. The first one we start out, so next slide, please, is we're looking here at the employment projections here statewide for the state. Overall, we're anticipating another 398,000 additional residents here in the state of Nevada. Of those, 138,000 roughly, we anticipate will join the job market. So for total employment, will be around 2.3 million. So roughly of that proportion, 37% is what we're forecasting to join the job market. As you can see here, there are two ways that we look at what are the top contributors to that employment growth. One is the growth rate, so the fastest growing rate. And then the second one is the largest contributor to employment, so total employment, total employees, what was the largest there from a level standpoint. For the growth rate, we're seeing social assistants, couriers and messengers. So couriers and messengers is essentially people who work, say, for UPS, FedEx, kind of shipping, warehousing and storage. There's many doctors in this room, so you understand what when you start from a low base, you get a high growth rate. From the employment sector side, though, for absolute actual levels of employment, it's healthcare, real estate, professional technical services, and then our core competencies across the state of food and drinking and accommodation, so hospitality and leisure. Next slide, please. Then we break it down for Clark County. Our forecast projects that 88% of all job growth in the next 10 years will come here in Clark County. 36% of the 340,000 people that we anticipate moving here in the next 10 years, we expect to enter the workforce or be a part of the workforce. In terms of fastest growing industries, we see again similar patterns across the state, so social assistance, couriers and messengers, support activities. Well, you see very low base there, so starting from 7 going to 49. But largest in contributors to employment of growth, so again, absolute levels of growth in employment we see coming from ambulatory healthcare services, real estate, professional technical services. And then next slide, please. We then have for Washoe County, where we are anticipating an additional 40,000 residents in the next 10 years, and of that, 13,687 additional jobs, or roughly 34% of that share being a part of the additional, being a part of the workforce. Again, similar story in terms of growth rates, couriers and messengers, social assistance, warehousing, but when we get into employment, then we see, again, couriers and messengers, real estate, professional, scientific, and technical services. That concludes my presentation, or for this portion of the presentation, I hand it back to Dr. Steinman up north. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Woods. Next slide. Again, the first part of the program gap analysis really looked at the change in different metrics related to each of the major and detailed occupation sectors. Next slide. As part of that work, we identified these 14 target occupation sectors for the United States. These 14 targeted occupation sectors at the major level and then associated detailed occupation sector level, really again based on kind of a number of factors, looking at the change over the last several years in total employment by occupation sector, but also the change in the location quotient, kind of a measure as to whether or not you have enough internal local supply across the state of workers versus whether or not you're having to import workers from outside the state to fill positions, and then different measures of both the hourly wage and then annual incomes earned by workers in those occupation sectors. And of course, these 14 targeted occupation sectors align, I think, very nicely with the work that Director Woods and his team at the Center for Business and Economic Research have really identified. This analysis presented for these 14 targeted occupation sectors are, again, utilizing data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor and Statistics, but again, dovetail nicely and are very consistent with the projections at both the state level and for Clark and Washoe counties that Director Woods just presented to you. Before I kind of get into the nitty-gritty details of each of the occupation sectors selected, a couple kind of big major conclusions from this study. First and foremost, again, when we overlay enrollment and graduation data across the Nevada system of higher education and its individual campuses, I think it's very fair to say that ENCHI and the individual campuses are actually doing very well in terms of aligning certificate, degree, and just kind of in general enrollment trends with each of these targeted occupation sectors and the anticipated growth over the next 10 or so years. That said, you know, as we talked about back in April and as outlined in both technical reports, there is still a major workforce shortage across these occupation sectors and others as well. That seems kind of a bit of a paradox, especially when you look at statewide and county by county unemployment rates, especially for the large metro areas. Nevada's unemployment rate remains to a certain degree stubbornly high, yet we see significant vacancies across different occupation sectors, both at the major and detailed level across the entire state. Typically, those two conditions don't really exist. If you have relatively high unemployment rates, you don't typically see a ton of opening positions, either because individual firms are cutting back and scaling back operations, or there's just kind of a surplus of available workers and more workers than there are available positions available. Or, of course, the vice versa condition in which you have relatively low unemployment rates, but not enough workers to fill increasing numbers of vacant and open positions. But again, it wouldn't be fair to say that ENCHI or even the K-12 CTE programs are not aligned with the demand for workers by individual employers in these occupation sectors. Again, there's kind of a disconnect where that growth is occurring and where we expect the need for additional workers in these occupation sectors. Kind of the limiting issues or conditions to really kind of filling those positions is just not enough bodies. And part of that is a lack of available housing options and high cost of living, either in our metro areas or non-metro areas, a lack of education and child care services to essentially, you know, be able to watch and educate children while mom and dad are off to work, and then kind of a lack of available health care services. Periodic surveys of workers throughout the state or potential workers that may be interested in moving to Nevada really indicate that those issues, housing, education, child care and health care services are reasons why individuals may be leaving the state in certain geographic areas or unwilling to move this to the state. So again, that misalignment, if you will, between where the workforce is in the state and what the demand is in the occupation sectors really isn't a function of course enrollment or graduation. The ENCHI institutions are actually very well aligned with the growth in these occupation sectors based upon existing enrollment and graduation data. It really is more of a community development concern. But that, I think, suggests areas of collaboration between ENCHI, the counties, the cities, regional development authorities, and other economic development organizations to kind of better tighten the pipeline between, you know, students who are graduating or coming out of certificate, associate, and bachelor's degrees across ENCHI and where the jobs are moving forward. Wanted to quickly go through each of the 14 targeted occupation sectors and some kind of the key takeaways. Next slide. For each of the 14 targeted industry sectors, the first four bullet points is kind of data and overview taken from the Bureau Bureau of Labor and Statistics periodic survey of employers, when the BLS is essentially asking employers, hey, what are the associated skills that you're looking for in employees in this occupation sector, as well as what are frequently required degrees, certifications, and licenses that employers are looking for. So those first four bullet points in blue are really mined from the BLS and their surveying of employers specifically within the state of Nevada. So at the very top, you see associated skills for management occupations, again, as a blend of hard and soft skills, financial management, data analysis, other things like time management, delegation, teamwork, collaboration, adaptability, and motivation. For frequently required degrees, certifications, and licenses, again, this is an exhaustive list, but is the most frequent identified by employers in this throughout the state of Nevada in the management occupation sector. A bachelor in business, finance, or accounting was most frequent. CPA, the most frequently required certifications, and then from licensing, various state insurance licensing requirements were identified by employers. The last five bullet points, the one in black, are really kind of the overlay of enrollment and graduation data. The first two bullet points, associated top 10 most enrolled courses and then subjects, that's for across ENCHI, where we looked at kind of top 10 courses and subjects. That really aligns with the associated skills bullet. And again, this is kind of one of the challenge of a program gap analysis today, is that employers are moving increasingly away from like degree or certification requirements, while licenses are still important, and are really looking for certain associated skills. Skills that can be associated to individual courses that students are taking, or just kind of general subject areas. And again, within the top 10, we see significant enrollment in individual courses and subjects that are really producing individuals that are, you know, having those associated skills that employers in management occupations are looking for. The last three bullet points, again, across ENCHI, looking at those top 10 degree and certification graduation rates, bachelor and or associate degree by field, and then bachelor and or associate degree graduation by major, kind of really ties to frequently required degrees, certifications, and licenses. And again, you know, we see good, strong alignment within the management occupation sectors. Students coming out with an associate's or bachelor's degree in those degree fields listed for top 10 degree and certification graduation by field and by major are producing the students that are in demand in the management occupation sector. But again, it really is more just kind of a function of not enough of. It's not that ENCHI is not producing students in this area. It's just simply not enough to fill the demand that we're seeing in the management occupation sector. Next slide. And again, I'll try my very best not to just kind of read details here, but kind of point out things. For associated skills, again, in business and financial occupations, more of those technical soft skills, industry knowledge, very similar to what you see in the management and occupation sectors. No real consensus by individual employers in terms of what they're looking for in terms of required certifications and licenses. But again, we see strong alignment in terms of where students are enrolled, both in terms of courses and subjects, and the skills that individual employers in this occupation sector are looking for. We also see good, strong alignment in terms of top 10 degree and certification graduation rates by field and by major, and again, what individual employers are looking for. And this is kind of going to just be a bit of a broken record and a repetition. But again, it's not that the ENCHI campuses aren't producing graduates and students in the fields and in the degree programs that employers in business and financial occupations are looking for. It's just simply not enough to meet current demand. And it's again, not necessarily a current demand issue that ENSHE itself can address. Part of the problem is really those underlying community development concerns of a lack of available housing, a lack of available education and child care services, and a lack of available health care services that simply just don't allow individuals to live in those communities where demand for business and financial occupation sectors is relatively high. Next slide.
Dr.
For
do you mind?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, do you mind if I butt in here? So before
please.
Before we go over the next 12 slides, I had a chance to review them. I hope the committee did. I'd actually like to have a conversation, if that's okay, instead of because here's what I'm taking from your work and Director Woods's work. Nevada, we've been talking about diversification for, let's just say, 20 years. We know it's longer, but, you know, the economic downturn, the pandemic, bookends of a decade showed us that economic diversification is the most important thing that we can do. ENSHE is a huge part of that. We are the workforce pipeline for this state. We know that. We have 7 teaching institutions that have taken this charge, and I will commend every single one of them. They are doing a good job. You're telling me, and Director Wood said the same thing, right? They have aligned certificates and degrees that are filling anticipated growth. That is a message that we should be talking about all day long. I think where I would like to see this work be implemented is the Board of Regents, the Chancellor, our presidents need to actually work with the RDAs, with the Regional Economic Development Authorities. We need to work with GOED. We need to work with the governor's office. We need to work with the legislature. We need to work with all these bodies to say, hey, our two institutions teamed up. They came up with a 14-point plan where they think that they're going to be, these are jobs of the future. We're on pace to fill these positions. When you go out and recruit businesses to move here, make sure they're in these next codes. This is our promise to you as a state. This is who we're going to be training, and we're going to work to scale that up. Right now we have that conversation with our RDAs, with our Regional Economic Development Authorities. We have that conversation with the governor's office. So they should be saying, hey, I want to see businesses that check these boxes. And if you go back to your slide, if you want to go back to page 9, there's 14 targeted occupation sectors. These are wide ranging. We're not saying that it's just in one field. We just want mathematicians. These are wide ranging. And so I actually think that what I would like to have a conversation about is the how. How do we message this for every other entity in the state to get on the same page, to work together, hand in glove, whatever analogy we need to say, hey, this is the future. We will work our best to make sure that we're filling that demand. Are you going to bring us the jobs to make sure that our students can stay here, that we're not wasting taxpayer-subsidized education because they can't find a job here? And that's why I'm so excited that we have this report now, because I do think that that needs to be our biggest talking point. Right, our R1 institutions, our 4 community college, and our university, they are all going to train staff, and we're going to make sure we focus on these industries. But how do we know that the state is going to fulfill their promise to make sure that they, you know, have jobs? So, yeah, please read your Brigger.
So Susan Brigger for the record, and I appreciate the slides, but I do my homework, and so I'm kind of, like, can we ask questions and get where we want to go? No disrespect for what you do, but I think people should all do their homework, and then we're here to move it forward. I think a great place would be, I'm on the Governor's Workforce Development Board, and Dr. Brown goes to most of those meetings, if not being online. This presentation, a brief part of this presentation, would be excellent there, and I'm happy to ask the chair. I think that if they see, especially the 14 targeted occupation sectors, we meet, I feel like it's more than quarterly. It just feels like it's always. But I think that this would be where, another place, not where, that we would show, here's what we're doing in our system, and are you going to, if we show you these are the necessary jobs, how do we do that as a workforce development board to make sure that that is getting out there, not just to the governor, but to our legislators? And I think that's where I think this would hit home. And so that's just a suggestion. If it wants to be carried out, I'm happy. Or Dr. Brown can bring that forward to that group. We meet next week. I wish there were no December meetings that late in the month. But we meet next week, and that would be a great time to bring it up, to share that this is where we need to go. We know it. And I think we need the others to know it.
Thank you, Regent Brager. Regent Brown, for the record. I do think that what yours and Director Woods's presentation is giving to me, and to piggyback a little bit on what Regent Brager said, I do think that we need to be more forward thinking in our have a conversation, have a program. Unfortunately, I don't know if you guys have this in the north, and I apologize, but I know CBER has amazing programming that talks about different pieces of our industry and how it's moving the needle forward, how we're developing as a community from a not just the statistics and numbers, but the people behind it and how that's backfilling. Quite frankly, this is a conversation that we need to have, right? This is now, the work has been done. We know that GoEd pays these RDAs to go and, you know, recruit businesses, but who's holding them accountable to make sure that we're filling these gaps and that, you know, higher ed is a consideration when we're going after and making strategic plans? And I would really love to put together some type of programming and take it on the road, right? When I first got on the board, I actually had asked to be part of the governor's workforce. And they ended up bringing someone from NG, Dr. Brown. So we do have a higher ed representative on there now, and that's great because I know conversations are being had about things that they want to see, but they didn't have us at the table. Now we do. Now we can have that conversation. And I know our RDAs have, regional economic authorities, have our presidents on their boards, but it is not part, I know because I used to work for one of them, I know that it is not part of the dialogue. And so I really want to make sure, and maybe I'll throw it on new business, that we come up with some strategic way to have this be a presentation. And because I want to take both of your vision, both of your work, and not just have it live in an echo chamber where we're upset that we're not doing it, that we, you know, need to do something. There are people, there's workforce connections, there's, you know, the Nevada Education Authority, right? Like, there's all of these different bodies that are talking to each other about wanting to change, but you guys have put together an actual roadmap, and the higher ed system, which is the, I'll say this until I'm blue in the face, it is the workforce pipeline of the state, is saying, hey, we want to meet these demands, but we all have to get together and have a conversation. So that's what I'm most excited about, this gap analysis, because we are putting real NAICS codes to the fact that we have future trajectories. Like, you've mapped it out. We don't have to guess. I think Regent Brager. And I'm sorry for anyone on Zoom. I can't see you. So if you would like to comment, please send me a text message or feel free to pipe up.
I'm going to add one more piece to this. So I chair the governor's subcommittee on childcare for the workforce. We can do all of this, but if people can't go to work because they can't afford to put their child in daycare, it's $17,000 a child. So unless you have some major job and you also have more than one child, you're looking at $30,000-$40,000 a year in daycare. This is I've chaired this for 3 years, and we're going to do a a spit out. In February, Councilman Scott Black and the City of North Las Vegas has graciously said that they will do this with me because we need everyone at the table. And it's from workers or employees to employers, that need to buy into this because we can do all this. But if people can't take a job because they can't have somewhere for their child, we've proven this over and over and did an amazing document that Director Wood would know because I'm just going to pitch. His wife was brilliant when she was there, and I worked with her in regards to what we sent out to the legislature. And I don't know if they really looked at it, but it shared everything that we needed for the jobs. So you can have jobs out there, but if people can't fill them. So I think we need to look at that as a piece of what we're doing so that we can let people. What every campus had a daycare. Every business that's large over so many people have a daycare. The hotels that have massive employees have a daycare. We need to look at this globally, and we're part of that because we do put the workers out there. So I just don't want that to get ignored in the big piece of this puzzle. And Lisa would agree with me.
If I can really quickly again, Fred Steinman, University of Nevada, Reno, for the record, I wanted to reiterate that important point that Regent Brugger made about the private sector engagement and involvement. I think it's an often overlooked piece. As the chair pointed out, the idea of accountability, you know, for all parts of the system, and that includes the private sector as well. I think there to address these limiting factors that are contributing between the gap in terms of number of employees and workers that the pipeline through NG is producing and the demand that the private sector currently has, you know, is partially due to the lack of engagement in parts of the private sector. Not all the private sector by any stretch of the imagination. There are major employers throughout the state that are making major multi-billion dollar investments into housing, education, childcare, and healthcare across the state. But it's simply not enough to recruit and retain the workforce in those communities. So, again, talking about that echo chamber, part of breaking that echo chamber is also having kind of blunt and very direct conversations with the private sector and establishing expectations for what the private sector should do beyond just creation of the job, that they need to be part of that recruitment and retainment effort as well, not necessarily just the private sector and nonprofit world.
I just want to jump in here. So Andrew Woods, director of the Center for Business Economic Research, for the record, and also echo Dr. Steinman's comments, but also Regent Brugger talking about childcare really quickly. I wanted to bring forward just some information that I can share later if you would like. CBER annually for the last 3 years has surveyed our unemployed population, and Dr. Steinman has helped me on some of the way we question this. And we are actually going into the field after the new year once again to statewide survey all the unemployed workers. We've looked and we get responses about childcare and what are the impediments and what industries are they interested in going into and what's holding them back if, say, childcare is one of those things. It's also things like transportation, lack of available skill training, whatnot. So I just want to point that out for the board that that resource is there and we're continually updating it and it's available to the public on our website. Thank you.
Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Brown. And I just want to make a comment on Regent Brugger's comment on the need for childcare. We find that I'm back in Washington, D.C. at our ACCT headquarters. And childcare is a huge component for our community college students. So I think the figure is at least 25 to 30% of our students are parents. And that's a lot. It's not the traditional graduate from high school at 18 and go off to college. So this is different. And it's very, very important. And I'll probably bring this up under new business, probably where it's going to be, Mr. Nielsen. But if we could take a look at the existing childcare on our campuses, because all of our campuses have waiting lists and they all need to be expanded. And I really feel it should be one of our legislative priorities going forward, because we're not going to be able to keep kids in school when they have childcare needs. And we combine these, like at Nevada State University, it's combined with their College of Education and their Department of They use the kids for the students to like internships. It's symbiotic. It's wonderful. And we just need expansion on that. So that's an excellent point. Thank you, Regent Brager. And that's all I have to say on that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this discussion. And I appreciate Dr. Simon and Director Woods for giving us your time and all the work that you and your team did to get us this data. I think my commitment as chair is that we're going to do something with it. And we'll definitely make sure we work with you guys to figure out what that looks like.
Great.
All right.
Thank
you. Agenda item number 6. We are going to talk about system-wide CPL efforts and workforce initiatives with Dr. Natalie Brown.
Well, Natalie Brown, for the record, Assistant Vice Chancellor for Workforce Development and Community Colleges. Waiting for my presentation. Oh, thank you. I will just apologize now. I don't have any building blocks, but I will make sure that I include that in future presentations. Yeah, so today I'm going to give a brief overview of some of the system-wide CPL workforce updates. And some of this we heard, I mean, you've not only heard it just in Dr. Archer's presentation earlier this morning, you know, we have been saying this and saying this because it is so important. You know, there are all these adults that hold some higher education, but no degree. The affordability, this is a cost-effective pathway to degree completion, as well as that speed to completion. We have done a lot of work with external partners, you know, trying to be as creative as possible, funding sources wherever we can. And this is just a few of those external partners we've now collaborated with. One being Constellation of Support with Student Ready Strategies and SHEO. And that's been such a wonderful partnership where Student Ready Strategies is working with each of our individual campuses and building their own CPL policies, platforms, and plans for the future. We've also been working with Holistic Credit Mobility Project with Ithaca SNR and Complete College America. I recently came back from presenting with colleagues from Ithaca SNR and the Missouri system about what we've been doing here in Nevada. And that has been a pretty exciting thing, seeing other states that are asking us, how did you do this? What does that look like? How did you work a policy through? And what kind of impact is that going to have? So some of this we're really building in real time. And Dr. Archer and I will be presenting also to another group about some of this great work we've been doing just next week. We also are on the Community College Growth Engine Fellows 2.0 project. So Dr. Archer and I have been working with a bunch of different system level leaders on some of this work as well, as well as the $75,000 Lumina Attainment Goal Project. And I'll be talking more about that in a sec. Education Design Lab and the Walton Foundation have also put out a proposal request for system-level dual-credit design proposals with a focus on community colleges. So we have just learned that we are a finalist in that work, so we have our finalist interview next week. One of the key things I want to touch on here is where I think we have such a great chance at this grant is their focus is going to be on collaboration and alignment with the secondary, post-secondary, workforce partners, system-level lead, and we have all of these groups that are coming to the table for this interview, which is just really showcasing how we've done some great work in not only aligning in a complicated workforce ecosystem that we have in this state, but utilizing the size of our state and the different resources that we have to bring together GOED, OWN, ENSHE. And I just have to say that's been a wonderful partnership that we have across ENSHE as well with those three individuals, but also with our regional workforce development partners, bringing in industry sector partnership groups, as well as on this particular grant, our four community colleges who then would be working with 3 to 5 high schools. An overview of the fall 2025 Credit for Prior Learning convening that took place October 10th at Western Nevada College. This just gives you an overview of what we did there. So there was 70-plus faculty, staff, and administrators, so every institution had a group that came together for their Credit for Prior Learning group. Strong system-wide momentum here. We had student-ready strategies presenting and really kind of getting us all on the same page on what Credit for Prior Learning is, what we can do in this space, and how to also tailor that to each of our individual institutions on where they are, some of the strengths that they are where they already have been strong, as well as building in some other areas. Exploring each institutional's context, needs, and purpose, as well as some of that hands-on experience with a Constellation platform. And this is a tool that Student Ready Strategies is working with our institutions on, where they are building in their individualized assets for Credit for Prior Learning. So it's pulling it down into what is it that you want to do, how are you going to do it, and now let's create these custom-wide assets for you. Some of the institutional progress through the Constellation Ed. So all of the ENCHI institutions started in what they call the understanding phase. And that's kind of that baseline on what do you already have in Credit for Prior Learning, where are some of the gaps, where can we go, and then building that plan. So now all of our institutions are working with the coach from Tennessee that Dr. Archer mentioned, as well as Student Ready Strategies, and they're in that design phase. They will be working through that design phase, I believe, through the end of January or so, before they're moving into more of an implementation phase. But using this framework, so they're not only looking at institutional policies delivery models, how that aligns with some of the changes that we made at the system level, CPL policies, how can we maximize CPL credits? Also, where will this live at the institutions? We're working on that standardized exam acceptance here at the system level, which will be really helpful. And then some of those credential crosswalks. And I'd say the crux of all of the CPL work is these portfolio assessment processes. That's, I think, where we also get to a lot of these adult learners that we've been talking to is, you know, CPL is a huge umbrella. We're talking about credits by examination, we're talking about licensure certifications, we're talking about military credit. And really, I think the big lift that we're all kind of working towards is this portfolio assessment process. And that's where having those individualized conversations, what kind of learning, what kind of experience, how can we align this with your educational goals? And that, I think, really speaks to some of those adult returning learners as well. Some of the Lumina Foundation state attainment goal work that we're doing internally right now is kind of doing that reset. And where were we when this work started? So back in 2011, when the Nevada system was at more of a 30% attainment goal, we updated this work with the board in 2019 as well as 2022 to update some metrics on persistence, graduation, targets to hit 60% educational attainment in the state of Nevada at that point was by 2020. Now that 60% goal of education attainment with the Lumina Foundation is through 2040, and that counts associate degree or higher, and Nevada is currently at 45% education attainment. Through the Lumina Foundation, that sets us at 51st out of 50 states, Puerto Rico, and D.C., so we have some ways to go. Now, looking back at some of the work that was done previously, we did a great job of hitting those targets on graduation, increasing the number of graduates statewide. What we didn't factor in is the amount of growth we are going to see in the state of Nevada. So as we have continued to grow, some of those previous targets didn't hit the 60%. So that's something that we're looking at now. How can we forecast, look at some of these graduation rates and just the numbers, as well as looking back at some of the persistence targets that were set by the board back in 2019 and updated in 2020. So be on the lookout for this as we have these internal conversations, bringing this to our campuses, and then we will be bringing this to the board to update some of those metrics and targets. Some of the priorities that are coming through this next year and beyond, I mean, one of the things is definitely this credit for prior learning work. So continuing that institutional design, working with our institutions as they figure out what works best for their campuses, but also standardizing military credit, adding that to the crosswalk that we are creating with the standardized test exams. Aligning secondary CTE, articulated credit, dual credit, anywhere we can do that within CPL, but even more generally, as that is an important space as well. And then building that system-wide transparency with that crosswalk, and then anywhere that we do have these standardized acceptance of credit, whether that's test credit, military credit, licensure certifications, kind of building that on a system-wide level so that anybody who is interested in some of those credits can see how that will be applied, and it will be the same across the system. Some of the workforce initiatives, I just want to add on this, you know, I should have put it on here, but it's something that we are continuing, is strengthening the alignment with our workforce partners. So NCHE does have a seat at the quarterly GOED meetings with the regional development agencies, which has been great. And again, that partnership between NCHE, OWN, and GOED has just been phenomenal, I think, for some of this work moving forward. But then also, I mean, that's just our state level. We then are really bringing that down. So whether that's our regional workforce development partners, local boards, and as well as working with EDON and LVGEA and some of the economic development initiatives. Some of the, I think, the strengthening employer-recognized credential crosswalks, that's definitely on the list as well, as I think that's a key area where we can be looking at, you know, particularly some of these areas that do have lots of licensure certifications, and we can quantify that and then build that into different programs and value that in a credit space. This is something I know that we have talked about as well, but I wanted to make sure we highlighted it here. Is this is so important because it does shorten that time to skilled employment, especially at a time where we heard we are doing a lot of great work, but we don't have enough people in these roles. So wherever we can shorten that time to completion, great, that's going to help us as a state overall in the workforce space. Recognizing the in-demand competencies, having a call just yesterday with the community college system in Colorado about how we can build some of these micro-credentials in behavioral health and wellness, what would that look like, and how is that operating in Colorado, and how can we bring that work here? Helping employers upskill, reskill, and get some of their current employees into different types of roles and upskill into different areas, as well as just supporting the workforce needs and, as always, aligned with the GOED target sectors. So just what's coming for 2026? So finalizing the CPL institutional design decisions, drafting, you know, different guides to help our institutions work through what this, you know, how to utilize this new policy framework in on their campuses. Updated attainment goal recommendations will be coming to the board. Dual credit CTE alignment, you know, definitely on the table. We need to work in that space, and I think that will definitely help strengthen also some of those pathways and relationships that we have in that P20 level. We will have the next statewide CPL convening. We're looking at dates now. I don't know if we finalized yet, but we're looking at maybe late March, early April. Once we have that date, we will be sure to let you know as well. And again, launching a site and that crosswalk for public transparency. And overall, just to land on this message here is, we are building this consistent, transparent, statewide CPL ecosystem. We have other systems that are asking us what we're doing, how we're doing it, and how they can do the same thing, which, again, is just a really cool place to be. And accelerating our students and individuals' path to employment in Nevada. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Brown. I really appreciate that. You know, we cannot reiterate this enough, this systeminess that we're really embracing, this opportunity to matriculate faster and more succinct and with more clarity is just going to make us a bigger bargaining chip when we go, and hopefully our institutions, I think Regent Brager asked this, but it is our institutions that go into the high schools that talk about why they should, come to their specific institution. And I like that that's happening. And, you know, we're just giving them more ammunition to get people excited to come here. So I think this is a great way that we can, this committee can spend our time, because we are genuinely investing in the future of Nevada by making sure that this is clean and then it is easy. So I just want to say thank you to both you and Vice Chancellor Archer for all of your work that you're doing. Does anybody on the committee have questions? Regent Gogajia, you always have good questions. You have anything for us?
No, I'm sorry, right now, except we've got it's going to be a heavy lift. There's no doubt about it as we look at this. And again, we're dealing with all pieces of it. Once we get even beyond education, when again, talk housing and these are all child care. They're all something we're going to have to deal with, and we're just a part of it. So, but thank you. Great job. And we'll keep working. Keep swinging.
Committee Chair Brown, Regent McGrath.
Please, Regent McGrath.
Just very quickly, I just wanted to get a better sense for timeline. And thank you so much. The presentation is wonderful. The work is wonderful. When do we think that this would be fully implemented? And I think a follow-up to that also is, doing this work, is it going to be an ongoing project? Or, you know, what do we anticipate for the future, and how often does it need to be reviewed? You know, going through this process now, what would you think about that?
Thank you for the question. Natalie Brown for the record. This will definitely be ongoing. We have included different checkpoints to continually review and assess and make sure we are in alignment, and when we have institutions bringing new ideas or crosswalk information to the table, then we can make sure that we're voting and have that all in alignment. So yes, it will be ongoing. As far as the timeline, you know, like we mentioned, there is a lot of moving parts here. So working not just across our different institutions, the faculty partnerships at each of the institutions, as well as our administration partners, as well as different agencies. So this is big lifting work, but good work. Now, timeline, some of it we're looking at, are there other resources out there? And like I said, all the good vibes out there for next week on this finalist for the dual credit grant, because that, I think, could really swing that dual credit CTE articulated credit kind of to the forefront of what we're looking at for 2026, and that would be a two-year grant cycle on that. You know, if not, it's still part of our timeline, but we might be looking then at military credit and how to align that. So some of it we're looking at what resources and how to be strategic and smart with the resources that we have. And so some of that, I think we'll have a better idea before the end of this year, and we can then definitely come to the table with a clear next steps, this project, as well as some of the ongoing projects are happening in different spaces at the campuses. So some campuses might be already working on that portfolio assessment and review, and some are focused more on military credit. So it is a little yes, and you know, this work is continually happening. It's at different levels at our institutions, but at the system, you know, seeing how we can be strategic and smart with different resources that we happen to come across.
Thank you for that. It's exciting work. Thank you.
Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Brown. And one of the reasons I'm back here at ACTT is we're already planning the next Leadership Congress. It'll be in Chicago from October 21st to 24th. And I am very proud of the work that you, Heather, Regent Brown, have brought to this board and this committee with the credit for prior learning. And what was just said by Assistant Vice Chancellor Brown is we're going to have a session, an access session is going to be a big focus of our workshops that get offered, especially with the credit for prior learning. And I know from December now till October next year, we'll have it but we'll be in a much better space where we're going with all of this. And I just think this work is great. And if we can't get our students on campus, that is access. And I'm just letting you heads up, We'll have a great seminar from ENCHI at Leadership Congress next year with our community colleges. So I just wanted to put that out on the record for next year. Just kind of encapsulates what this committee does. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo. And I'll just echo my time at ACCT this past October, I guess 2 months ago now. It was enlightening to me because I had an opportunity to speak with several of our colleagues around the country and learn some best practices. And I think what you're highlighting here, military service is one of those. We know that there are already a transcript that they get at the end of their service. So that is something that is clearer for us to be able to translate to. And we already know there's national standards that and other institutions and systems that have created processes. And so we're not reinventing the wheel. We are very much borrowing and leaning in on other. And this is why we're part of these bigger boards and these bigger organizations. It's because we don't live in a vacuum. We're not just talking to each other. We're actually working with our colleagues. So, and I know all the leads and everything that you're chasing. And so I just want to say thank you for, keeping those conversations going, because it is important, right? This is why we invest in our ability to have these conversations with these national organizations. So, all right. Is there anyone else with any last comments before we move in? Carvalho, Regent Carvalho? Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to first of all say thank you to Dr. Brown for her work in this area. I know that it's a new innovative way in higher ed for us to be thinking about it. And I'll just lend you my support and whatever we can do on the board to get out the communications once we're ready to ramp up credit for prior learning and put it out there. I think it'll take a lot of effort on our part to make sure that this is out there in the public for those 321,000 residents who may not have thought about coming back to higher education or didn't know how to do it. We need to make sure that we have supports for them to understand how to go through this process and support them throughout the entire time. So I'll just say that when you're ready for that public facing work, I would think I know as a regent, I will definitely share it and do whatever I can to help you get that out there. Thank you.
Much appreciated.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Brown. All right, we are going to go into agenda item number 7, new business. Are there any regents on the committee that have new business? Okay, I have a new business item I would like to propose. I would like to propose to formally rename the Workforce Committee and change its mission to include Workforce Research and Economic Development Committee. This is actually a callback. Dr. Brown had mentioned this to me almost 15 years ago. This was actually the name of the committee. And so I think as we expand our scope, it is more fitting. And so I think this will better reflect the committee's comprehensive charge and evolving priorities. This change aligns with the committee's expanded focus on workforce transformation, applied research, industry partnership, and innovation ecosystems. Along with the name change, the proposal reaffirms the committee's responsibility to support workforce development across all ENCHI institutions and to guide policies related to technology transfer, entrepreneurship, and the commercialization of intellectual property. These updates will help ensure ENCHI is well-positioned to meet the demand of Nevada's growing innovation economy and to support sustainable long-term economic growth across the state. All right, seeing no new business, we're going to move to...
Excuse me. I had new business. I texted you.
Okay. Go ahead, Regent Del Carlo.
Sorry. Okay. I mentioned on the childcare, I'd really love to see a report on for our campuses on what they offer, what their capacity is, what their wait lists are, and what it would take just approximately dollar-wise to expand and offer more. I really think we need to know that. I see you shaking your head, Regent Brager. I'm really glad to see that because, and I have to do a shout out to Western Nevada College because they are continually rated number one in their community of Carson City, our capital city, as the number one choice for parents to send their children to daycare. And I think they start with babies at six weeks. So, and I do know there's a big waiting list and there is room to grow. So thank you. That's my new business. And I appreciate this committee and everything old is new again. And that's a much better name. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Seeing no new business, we're going to move into agenda item number 8, public comment. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There is none.
Okay. Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
There is none.
Is there any public comment here in Las Vegas? Seeing none. SES, is there any public comment on the phone?
There's no public comment at this time.
All right. Well, thank you so much, and we will adjourn the Workforce Committee at 10:51.